writer's voice. To celebrate our 30 years of on-air service, Virginia Voice's Patty Campbell talks to noted writers about their lives and work.
I'm your host for these programs, Patty Campbell, and tonight I'm very happy to welcome Times Dispatch reporter Peter Baquet. Peter, welcome.
Thank you, Patty. Good to be here.
It's great to have you here. I have seen many stories in the paper that were related to the weather and to aviation that had your byline. Are you covering those areas plus other areas, or what are you doing at the TD now?
These days I'm a business writer at the paper, and I cover primarily transportation and energy issues, and that involves a certain amount of aviation coverage, but primarily with the air travel.
But you have covered those other areas.
Oh, absolutely.
How long have you been at the TD?
30 years, actually.
Wow. Does that represent your whole career, Peter?
No, I had worked at the Daily Progress in Charlottesville from 1972 to 1979. And before that, I had gotten my start in journalism by working at an Army newspaper, the 3rd Infantry Division Frontline in Germany.
So I take it you were in the Army.
Oh, yeah. Yes, I was drafted in 1969.
What have you brought to read for us?
I've got a couple of stories here that have sprung by and large from my military coverage, and I like them because they talk about humanity, I think, and it's sort of unexpected, I would think, on the part of most people, that there's so much goodness rolling around the military, but there is. This story ran in January of 2008. America is a wealthy, open-hearted country, and generosity, for many folks, comes pretty easily. For some others, giving comes with a deeper dimension. Yesterday, residents of the Virginia home presented a check for $11,315 to the Families of the Wounded Fund. On 2 days in December, 40 of the home's residents swam laps to raise money for the fund that helps families of troops wounded in combat operations in Iraq and Afghanistan. We want to show that we have not forgotten the sacrifices of our servicemen and women, said Al Allen, president of the home's residents council. We want to acknowledge the great debt we owe their families. What makes their gift remarkable is that the home's residents are all severely disabled, much like the soldiers whose families the residents are helping. The residents' conditions include cerebral palsy, quadriplegia, brain injury, stroke, and degenerative disorders such as multiple sclerosis and muscular dystrophy. Most use wheelchairs, including 39 of the swimmers in the aquathon. There's absolutely nothing as compelling as what you've done. Cal Eslick, president of the Families of the Wounded Fund and a Marine Corps veteran of Vietnam, told the residents. The fund's representatives, all who served in combat and not given to public emotion, were moved to tears. I don't have the right word for this, Eslick said before yesterday's presentation of the residents' gift. It's extraordinary that people in that situation in life are thinking about how they can help somebody else. They're certainly people with their hearts in the right place, he said. An attendant had to be in the pool with the participants while they were swimming. We have special chairs we put them in that we use to roll them right down into the pool, Bob Krause, the home's administrator, explained. But the fundraising event's self-imposed rules require the swimmers to propel themselves through the water unaided. Having solicited financial pledges from family, friends, and acquaintances, each participant had 20 minutes to swim as many laps as possible in the 45-foot-long pool. Harry Lancaster, who's 72, was the aquathon's top fundraiser, bringing in $1,088. He wanted to help the Families of the Wounded Fund, he said, because they've been making sacrifices for us. This year's fundraising total was almost twice the largest amount raised in previous aquathons. Past beneficiaries of the aquathons include the Shaco Relief Fund, Flood Ravage Franklin, Virginia, the United Way's September 11th Fund, and Habitat for Humanity's Gulf Coast Post-Hurricane Rebuilding Project. The private nonprofit home's residents require round-the-clock care, the kind their own families and other facilities can't provide. Their average age is 43. In spite of the difficulties they face in their lives, they're community-minded, Krause said. Many have performed volunteer work for other charitable organizations, other community services. They care about their fellow citizens in the same way you and I do. As challenging as their lives are, Virginia home residents scuba dive, ride horseback, ski, speak and write with the help of adaptive equipment, work, and volunteer in the community. Midlothian-based Families of the Wounded Fund helps family members and other caregivers, while service members injured in combat get medical treatment at McGuire Veterans Affairs Medical Center in Richmond. Started in 2005, the Families of the Wounded Fund has raised more than $1.1 million for its work, aiding more than 80 military families.
A very, very impressive event, beautifully captured in your story.
Thank you.
What else have you brought for us, Peter?
This appeared in 2007. A couple of years ago, the Army was going to show off its National Training Center to congressional staffers, media types, and community leaders from around the country. The center's home is Fort Irwin, California, in the middle of the very dry, very hot Mojave Desert. To kick the day off, the Army gave a briefing by the center's commanding general at 6 a.m. on a Saturday. Welcome civilians to the U.S. Army. No mission too difficult, no sacrifice too great. Duty first. We trained to be the most miserable army in the world, a captain in Kosovo once told me ruefully. More sweat, the military says, less blood. I've covered the military on and off for 35 years. It's been an eye-opening journey. To civilians, the American military is often a foreign world. The armed forces are strange societies, speaking a language packed with impenetrable acronyms and terms of art. MOSs and ALMCs, logistics over the shore and setting the force and engaging the enemy with suppressive fire. Military people also think, for very good reasons, in ways that are typically unknown to civilians. For instance, they're obsessive about staying in top physical condition. More PT, they yell, while doing physical training. Many of them need it. An obvious reason for this enthusiasm: the basic load of personal equipment that ground pounders carry on their bodies during operations runs from 80 to 120 pounds. But what fundamentally sets covering the military apart from almost any other area of news is that soldiers, sailors, Marines, and airmen have signed a voluntary contract to provide unlimited personal sacrifice to the nation. In short, their job is to fight wars in defense of the country and, if necessary, die for the American people. Getting shot at or blown up, mortared or rocketed, these things come in an ordinary and long day's work. And wars are never fought in nice places, especially not after the fighting starts. Life in the field, even in the best of times, is often guaranteed to make troops hot, dirty, tired, and mad. And the service members stay for numbingly long periods of time. Those conditions of everyday life put a different light on the military's otherwise difficult-to-fathom activities. Because members of the military wear uniforms, people can fall into the trap of thinking that the men and women in uniform are uniform. They're not. They are the most amazingly diverse, polyglot, funny, hard-edged, hard-working, cantankerous, spiritual, irreverent, bright, though occasionally lunk-headed, insightful, an inspiring collection of characters you're ever likely to meet. Given that their business revolves around the carefully calibrated application of deadly force and the willingness to put themselves in the path of danger in a thousand forms, from being sniped at to being catapulted off of carriers to handling high explosives to operating large equipment in rough terrain, military folks are astonishingly upbeat about life. Not for nothing is the motto of the Army's Corps of Engineers, Essayons. Let's try. Go figure. Maybe warriors just have to be optimists or go nuts. The American military is a huge organization, and it's not faultless. No group is. And it's easy to disagree with the political decisions that underlie the military's mission. But it's hard to quarrel with the honest hearts and the good minds of the members of the U.S. Armed Forces.
Another very nice piece. Tell me a little bit about your own military experience. You said you were in Germany, that you were drafted.
Right. I was drafted in the middle of the Vietnam War in 1969, right after I graduated from college. And
you went where?
I went to college in Louisiana, a school that's now called the University of Louisiana at Lafayette.
Were you from Louisiana?
Yes, I may be the only real Cajun you're ever going to meet. And went through basic training at Fort Polk, Louisiana, was sent to train in a technical military occupational specialty repairing the aiming devices for tanks and artillery at Aberdeen Proving Ground in Maryland. Fascinating training. I knew nothing about that stuff, and it was highly technical and highly precise work. Discovered the Army does tremendous training. We had a class of 12 people, four instructors for every block of instruction. Blocks of instruction typically lasted 2 weeks, so the student-teacher ratio was very low. And I'm proud to say that I was also the student of the month at Aberdeen's Borden Center and School. It was the high watermark of my military prowess and achievement. After that, it was all downhill. I was, again, assigned in Germany by the luck of the draw. It turns out they didn't need us in Vietnam, and so a bunch of us in my class were sent to Germany. I ended up first being assigned as a clerk because I was a college graduate. I had a high Army testing scores. I could speak German, and better yet, I could type. And so the Army made me a clerk for a while. Eventually, I talked my way into the Division Information Office, what is now called the Public Affairs Office. And along the way, it turns out I was the only guy in the Information Office who could both speak German and write. And so I began to write for the division newspaper covering things on the German beat. And, it was the greatest job I'd ever had.
Did you ever think about making the military a career, or were you counting the days until you could get out?
I was counting the days. I had a short timer calendar like everybody else. In those days, you were drafted for 2 years. I actually, because the Army didn't need us, because by the time I approached the end of my term of service, the Vietnam War was winding down, we were given, at almost any excuse, early separations from active duty. In my case, it was to go to graduate school. I ended up in Virginia by coming to graduate school at UVA.
Do you think the experience of being in the military has informed the articles that you've written about the military?
Absolutely. Among other things, I speak in a rudimentary fashion, military ease. So I was able to understand most, but not all, of what the Army was saying.
Because it is, as you said in your last piece, it is a different language.
Oh, boy, is it ever. I was covering a military symposium here in Richmond on logistics. It's a very big event and a very high-level event. And was watching yet another PowerPoint presentation with just a blur of acronyms on it and abbreviations. And I saw one that seemed to be key. It seemed to be coming up all the time in the officer's presentation as he spoke. And I turned to the contractor next to me, who had a laptop in his lap, and said to him, "What's that mean?" And he said, "I don't know," and turned back to his computer. And I thought, well, he's blowing me off, or he simply doesn't know. A couple of minutes later, he turned back to me and said, "It means ABC, whatever it was." He had to look it up. He had to Google it to find out what it meant. So it's a pretty abstruse language.
Speaking of language, read some more of your language for us.
Okay. Back in 2000, the American Legion here in Virginia gave me a very nice award for appreciation for the work I had done. And I was asked to make a talk at the American Legion convention in Roanoke. And because I'm a reporter, you never want to waste anything you write. So I took that little talk and banged it into a column, which ran in November of that year. On a cold morning in 1950, my father put on his Navy Chief's uniform, walked out into the country darkness, and flagged down a bus to take him back to duty during the Korean War. It was my father's third armed conflict. He left his home in South Louisiana in 1922 and joined the Navy. He was 17 years old then, and the Navy sent him to China for 4 years. No one had heard about six-month deployments being a hardship. He served in the classic four-piper and flush-deck destroyers, the original tin cans, of the Navy's Asiatic Squadron during the middle of China's Nationalist Revolution, steaming far up the Great Yangtze River, pulling shoreside guard duty at embattled U.S. compounds, and carrying the wounded back to Shanghai for medical care. He was a machinist mate in the days before air-conditioned engine rooms, when sailors were naturally expected to have broken noses and nicknames like Polak, Ski, and Frenchie. My father was one called Frenchie. He served in the Atlantic and the Pacific during World War II, and, so my mother told me, was torpedoed in the Pacific. My father never talked about his naval service, though it was really the overwhelming fact of his life, a service to which he gave almost 30 years. I expect he thought his experiences common. It was common for men of my father's generation to have spent time, frequently quite a lot of time, in one or the other of America's armed forces. They served in China, and Nicaragua, Haiti, or the Philippines, and then in World War II, like my father and his friend Henry Broussard. Mr. Broussard, his unlikely Navy nickname was Queenie, because he'd acted the part of King Neptune's consort in a crossing of the line ceremony at the equator, fascinated us children. He had a pig tattooed on one foot and a rooster on the other. Now, the Cajuns of South Louisiana are an exotic bunch, but Henry Broussard's pig and rooster tattoos were unusual even by our Rococo standards of life. Protected by the pig and the rooster, the Chinese belief went, a sailor would never drown at sea. And sure enough, Mr. Broussard never drowned. But Queenie Broussard was captured by the Japanese in the Philippines at the start of World War II. He survived the Bataan Death March, spent the war as a POW slave laborer in Japan. Our fathers and uncles and teachers, such as burly, heavy-eyebrowed Coach O'Connor at my high school, served in Korea. My cousins were drafted or enlisted during the Cold War, including my cousin Philip LaHaye, who went into the Army, and his brother, my cousin Tom, who served as an Air Force doctor. Promotions didn't come fast then, and Tom claimed he was the oldest captain in the service. When Vietnam started to boil over, guys from my high school started to go off to war, like Paul Reel, who flew B-52s over Vietnam. Once Paul telegraphed his parents to assure them that he was all right when the downing of a bomber over Vietnam made the nightly news. It wasn't his bomber that had been shot down that time. The Reels framed that telegram. They put it on the wall with the treasured documents of their family history. Some of the guys I went to college with went to extreme lengths to avoid the draft. One friend starved himself for the best part of a year so he'd fail the physical examination by being underweight. In 1969, it was my turn to get a letter from the Lafayette, Louisiana Draft Board. I was drafted into the Army. I was not thrilled to go. But I ended up, thanks to a coincidence of national policy and the luck of the draw in Germany. My military service was unremarkable. My rank was Specialist 4, sort of a corporal without any authority, and I worked as a clerk for a while and then as a reporter and translator, hardly onerous duty. Draftees served in the U.S. Army for 2 years or less. I spent precisely 1 year, 10 months, and 11 days in the Army, most of which I found interesting, and much of it even pleasant. Parts of that time, of course, were, at least for an unathletic civilian such as myself, tedious at best and downright unpleasant at worst. Snatching a bit of sleep lying on the company street before morning formation and guard duty on frigid European nights come to the mind right off the bat. But being tired and bored and cold, or hot and dirty and tired, for long periods of time are ordinary conditions of existence for people in the U.S. Armed Forces. Sometimes it's unbelievably worse. The attack on the U.S. Cold and the terrible deaths and injuries of its young sailors emphasize again that nations exist in a hostile world, and the United States has more than its fair share of enemies. More often than not, the people who pay the final bill for America's protective power around the globe are the young men and women in the armed services. It's part of the unlimited liability contract every man and woman enters into when they raise their right hand and take the steel-bound oath of enlistment. Hundreds of thousands of young men and women are making that commitment to duty, to live not for themselves but for their country, every day in the all-volunteer services. Those sorts of experiences in the military are what millions of American citizens did for the half a century, from the beginning of World War II to the end of the Cold War, and continue to do today. It was our common duty and our common experience, and I discovered later our common bond. As time puts distance between me and those events, I see that what the men and women who served in World War II did, and those who served in Korea and in Vietnam and in the Cold War, and those who are serving now in places like Bosnia and Kosovo in the Persian Gulf, is not common at all. Now, when I write stories about such men and women, many of them very old, I find myself telling them, thank you. Thank you for what you did. It's the least I can do.
Lovely, Peter. As I'm sitting here listening to you read these stories, I am being reminded that we really do have military installations very near us. I don't think that in Richmond we necessarily see many uniforms or think very much about having the military so close by, but I guess we really do, don't we?
Virginia actually has, depending on how you count it, the largest military presence or one of the largest military impacts. It's always in the top three among all the states in the Union. The others vying with us are California and Texas. In terms of the amount of money spent on defense, the number of people employed in the defense industry, and simply soldiers, sailors, airmen, Marines stationed here.
You said that you are now writing for the business pages. Do the military stories make it into the business pages?
Not the way we're structured now. They are typically covered by our news desk.
Do you get pulled off and sent back to write some of those stories still?
So far, not. That has not been the case.
Okay. We have time for one more. Can you share one more story for us?
Sure.
With us?
This story arose from my coverage of the Virginia National Guard. And appeared in the spring of 2008. People cannot always do great things, but sometimes they can do small things with great kindness, even in a war zone. A little Iraqi Bedouin girl with a badly burned arm gave Captain John Brillhart, members of his Virginia Army National Guard unit, the chance to be kind. The story began, Physician Assistant Brillhart said, late one morning in early October, with a radio call from a combat medic on a route security mission somewhere in Iraq. The message relayed to his desk said a 4-year-old girl had fallen into her family's campfire, badly burning her right arm from hand to elbow. Brillhart is the medical officer of the State Guard 2nd Squadron, 183rd Cavalry, operating in southern Iraq and northern Kuwait from the unit's base in Kuwait. Without immediate treatment, the child's arm would become quickly infected and would have to be amputated. This girl needed definitive advanced care quickly, he said. This wasn't the first time local Iraqis needed medical care from Brillhart's troops, but because of the dangers from ambush, unexploded munitions, and roadside bomb attacks, U.S. commanders don't send their troops outside the wire lightly. Lieutenant Colonel Walter Mercer, a Hanover County schoolteacher, commands the squadron's 500 soldiers. After weighing the possible threats against Brillhart's recommendation, the cavalry squadron launched an emergency medical team into the night. 12 soldiers, 4 heavily armed and armored Humvees, and Brillhart. At the nomadic Bedouin's camp, he said, the guardsmen formed the gun trucks into a defensive perimeter, weapons charged in the desert. I can remember the peaceful stillness in the air as we walked toward the family's 3-sided tent, said Brillhart, who works in an orthopedic surgery center in Portsmouth. There were thousands of stars out and hundreds of sheep roaming freely at our feet. Still, the 44-year-old medical officer from Portsmouth acknowledged being nervous. We were not only making ourselves a target, but also my patient as well. Then, an elderly female dressed in all black emerged from the darkness holding a small child with her right arm outstretched, he said. Brillhart's examination revealed that the girl, whose name was Fatma, had suffered extensive second-degree burns from the tips of her fingers to her right elbow, he said. Bits of wood and sand stuck in the burned and blackened tissue. He removed the dead skin, a tedious and extremely painful process. I did see tears often, he said, and he dressed the wound. Fatma never flinched, Brillhart said. She is an extremely brave little girl. I remember the drive back from the camp, wondering if the girl would be okay throughout the night, he said. Truthfully, I never imagined I'd be doing this in the desert of Iraq with limited supplies and a not-so-ideal sterile setting. The next day, he and Sergeant First Class Jeff Peacock, a medic from Suffolk, returned to examine the burns. Fatma's care continued almost daily for several weeks as we meticulously debrided and cleaned her wounds, he said. By the American's third visit, she would greet Brillhart by name. She continued to remain strong throughout the encounters, he said, and we began to develop a special bond. The cavalrymen took Fatma's family under their wing, and the Virginians' relatives back home donated boxes of clothing for the Bedouins. Though communication, even with an Arabic translator, was difficult, Brillhart said, the family was extremely grateful. Then the nomadic sheepherders, in the midst of Fatma's care, folded their tents and vanished into the vast, desolate desert. We were devastated, Brillhart said, and I personally feared that I had not done enough to save the arm and hand from certain infection. Earlier last month, a patrol from the 183rd happened upon Fatma and her grandmother walking along the road the soldiers were covering. The girl had full use of her arm and hand. The badly injured limb had healed completely.
What a great story. Four great stories, Peter. Thank you so much for joining us this evening.
You're welcome, Patty. Thank you.
We've been talking with Peter Baquet, reporter for the Richmond Times-Dispatch. I'm Patty Campbell for the Virginia Voice.
You've been listening to The Writer's Voice. Listen online or download to your computer or MP3 player at www.virginiavoice.org. Virginia Voice. Connect by listening.